From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we examine what is known about the background of Osama bin Laden. We talk with Lowell Bergman, the correspondent for the PBS Frontline documentary on bin Laden. Bergman is now working on an updated version. Also, the relationship between bin Laden, the Taliban, and Pakistan. We talk with Thomas Gutierrez, director of the Center for Afghanistan Studies at the University of Nebraska in Omaha. The Jewish High Holy Days begin tonight. We ask Rabbi Burton Vizotsky to reflect on the Jewish New Year in the light of last week's attacks. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Leaders of Afghanistan continue to debate what they should do with their guest, wanted terrorist suspect Osama bin Laden. Senior Afghani leaders are meeting to debate his fate. U.S. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld says the problem of terrorism is much larger than bin Laden. He says the nation must be vigilant against it.
The best defense against terrorists is an offense. You simply cannot batten down the hatches and try to cope with every conceivable thing any terrorist could imagine to do. I mean, they've already done some unimaginable things. The only answer is to take the effort to them where they are.
The FBI continues to fan out across the country. Agents are following some 80,000 leads as they search for people who may be connected to last Tuesday's attacks. NPR's Barbara Bradley reports.
Currently, 49 people are in custody, and the FBI is investigating whether any of them might have been planning other hijackings. One avenue it's investigating, according to the Los Angeles Times, whether a group of men planned to hijack a plane this coming Saturday, a flight from San Antonio to Denver. Two men were picked up last week with box cutters similar to those used by the hijackers. Those men were on a plane going to San Antonio. The FBI also wants to question 200 other people. It's actively following leads in 10 states from California to Massachusetts. It's looking for patterns. For example, knowing that a dozen of the attackers had flight training, the FBI is checking out flight schools to see what other people might have learned to fly under suspicious circumstances. Barbara Bradley, NPR News, Washington.
NATO's supreme allied commander in Europe warns that a military campaign to strike back at those behind the terror attacks in New York and Washington will cost lives. Douglas Bakshin reports.
U.S. General Joseph Ralston told a news conference in Vienna, Austria, in his words, "We must all recognize that this is not a risk-free operation we are embarking upon." He said there will be casualties, a necessary part of any military operation. General Ralston said people should not expect that a single strike will end the problem. Instead, it will require a sustained effort over a long period of time by the entire international community. That effort will be political, economic, and diplomatic, as well as military. The general also praised NATO members and the European community for offering support in the fight against terrorism. General Ralston was in Austria to meet government ministers and observe a NATO Partnership for Peace exercise. For NPR News, I'm Douglas Bakshin.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 40 points at 89.61. Trading is very heavy. The Nasdaq is up 7 points at 15.86. The S&P 500 is up 2. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the FBI is now looking at a computer virus that is spreading on the Internet. The agency says it has targeted thousands of computers, and antivirus experts say it has the power to force entire company websites offline. The virus can also attack through email. Experts are warning computer users today not to open unexpected email attachments. The FBI has not indicated if the virus is connected in any way to last week's terror attacks. The Labor Department reports consumer prices rose modestly in August. Steve Beckner of Market News International has more.
Inflation need not worry the Federal Reserve at a time when it is trying to insulate the economy from the aftershocks of last week's terrorist attacks and keep it out of recession. The Consumer Price Index rose just 0.1% last month, while the core CPI, which excludes volatile food and energy, rose 0.2%. about in line with expectations. Prices were 2.7% higher than a year ago. Inflation was restrained in August by a dip in energy prices, and there is some concern energy prices could spike after last week's events. But with the economy in a weak state, inflation is expected to stay under control. The Fed made clear in cutting interest rates for the eighth time yesterday that it is much more concerned about recession than about wage price pressures. For NPR News, I'm Steve Beckner.
Ford Motor Company has settled a lawsuit with the family of a woman who died last year in a rollover accident. Margarita Gonzalez was riding in a Ford Explorer when the tread separated from a tire. The driver of the Explorer was Gonzalez's son. He was brain damaged from the accident. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News, from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value youth as a resource through research and programs, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In an attempt to learn about Osama bin Laden, the prime suspect in last week's attacks, many of us have been turning to a documentary on bin Laden, which was first produced for the PBS Frontline series in 1999 and has been showing again on many PBS stations. An updated version is being put together now in conjunction with the New York Times for broadcast on public television October 4th. My guest, Lowell Bergman, is the correspondent for the Frontline documentary. He's the former 60 Minutes producer whose role in the tobacco wars was dramatized in the movie The Insider. I spoke to Bergman earlier today. Bin Laden grew up in Yemen. His father became a construction magnate and amassed a fortune. I asked Bergman how he did it.
Well, his father made a connection with the royal family in Saudi Arabia and basically became their personal builders. The Yemenis are more, in many ways, more of a merchant group and less restrictive, generally speaking, religiously, than the sect that the royal family of Saudi Arabia comes from. And so they got a number of, if you will, choice contracts. In some ways, much the same way in many countries that people become the favorites of the government for building facilities. And the ultimate score for them was the rebuilding of the holy sites in Mecca and Medina. But they also went on to build airports and oil fields and become amongst the biggest contractors in the Middle East. They have a website that's up and available. It's spelled Bin Laden as one word. They are a prosperous company. They are the people who are involved, for instance, in launching the missile satellites, if you will, for worldwide satellite communications. For cell phones.
Wow. So bin Laden's father, who was from Yemen, ended up befriending King Saud of Saudi Arabia, rebuilding the mosques there, rebuilding the palace, getting all these big...
Well, this is a country that was coming from the feudal era to the modern era with a huge influx of cash.
Mm-hmm.
And so they became one of the major merchant families who helped handle that transition on a practical level.
Now, was Osama bin Laden trained to take over the family business?
Well, the understanding and the little information we have, and that's something that I'm working on right now with the New York Times and Frontline, is that he had a relatively dissolute youth, and his mother being the siring him and being one of the many wives, and he being amongst the youngest of the sons. And it was only... after he sort of knocked around as a young man, that he found his calling, which was to assist in the jihad in Afghanistan. Understand that at that time, he was no older than maybe his mid-20s when that war started. So it's in a sense, the story of somebody who apparently was involved in doing things that a Muslim wouldn't normally do, like drinking, dancing, and partying, and finding his way in this conflict.
Now, he had how many brothers and sisters? How big was the family?
You know, I always lose count. I think there's 20 brothers altogether.
This is from several wives.
Oh, yeah. I don't think one did all of that.
And a lot of sisters as well.
Right.
I've read somewhere between like 52 and 57 sisters.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little difficult to keep track.
Right. Now, he was married at the age of 17.
in an arranged marriage, as we understand it.
What happened to the marriage?
Well, frankly, I don't know what happened to the marriage. He's taken other women as wives, including one in the Sudan and apparently more recently one in Afghanistan. And he has a number of children.
He does?
Yeah. But okay. We don't know, at least publicly, we don't know how many.
Have you learned anything else about what his personality was like before he became an extremist, like when he was a child or a teenager or a young man in his 20s?
Well, apparently he was, from the contact we've had with some people who were close to him, he wasn't any more unusual or obnoxious or uninteresting than anybody else, nor did he stand out necessarily in any way. The key factor was that he, in his trip to Afghanistan, as did a lot of people who were, in a sense, adrift or, if you will, in the case of Egypt basically shipped most of the people in their jails to Afghanistan to fight.
So do you think he just kind of drifted into Afghanistan to fight there, or that he had some kind of almost conversion experience in which he became politicized and fired up in a religious way?
Well, I would only say, based upon what people say who either knew him or CIA people who were around at that time, he wasn't a well-known figure other than as a representative of that family. You know, the Saudi government and the bin Laden family gave a lot of assistance to the Afghan resistance to the Soviet Union. Milt Bearden, who we interviewed in the documentary and goes on at some length, that he had never heard of him, Milt being sort of the on-the-ground CIA coordinator at that time during the resistance to the Soviet resistance. He's built up somewhat of a mythology about himself and his and stories about himself being a combat leader. Most people think that he was part of a group which did do some fighting, but basically he was well known for providing logistical assistance, earth-moving equipment, supplies, rest and recreation areas, if you will, back on the Pakistan side of the border. And that's where a lot of people from around the world congregated and met each other. And his religious conversion, again, the traditional religion of the Saudis and of the royal family is quite strict itself. They are fundamentalists in their own sense. He came back to, in a sense, up the ante somewhat. So he's a person from a what we would call a more liberal background in terms of a Yemeni national who confronted with a government which was quite fundamentalist and conservative on the surface. But as he and everyone else knew, under the surface, they are, you know, known for partying in Marbella. You know, the traditional Saudi prince, when he gets out of the country, he goes to Afghanistan, has this experience of a religious war in which they win and defeat a superpower, and comes back, let's say, holier than thou, wanting to hold the family, the royal family in particular, to the higher standards that they aren't following.
So from what you've learned, his role in Afghanistan during the Soviet invasion, when he joined the Mujahideen, the resistance group trying to get the Soviets out, his role was primarily, we think, a financial one, using his share of the family fortune
to U.S. intelligence sources, that's the major role. It wasn't a major military role. According to the Saudi opposition groups, both above ground and to some extent underground, there is a story that he became a fierce guerrilla leader in the field. It depends on who you believe. It's probably a mixture of both.
I think it was about the time that the Soviet Union was pulling out of Afghanistan, bin Laden formed his own organization, which is known in English as the Base. Do you know what his original intention was with that organization?
Well, again, the people who actually have been part of it or who at that time or had some contact with it, and people in what is in London, basically, the above-ground Saudi opposition. Now, understand that in Saudi Arabia, there is no political opposition. And that's what you find as a current throughout this, whether they're Egyptians involved. You may have noticed there's a lot of people of Egyptian nationality who turn up as hijackers or terrorists. These are countries where there is no legitimate political opposition. And so whatever organization he intended to set up, which people in London have told us was really just a support organization, almost like an alumni organization of the war, and he brought many of these people with him to the Sudan, They set up all kinds of businesses there as well as some training camps. It didn't seem to get really radical in the sense of real action until 1995-96, when the United States and the Saudi government started pressuring the Sudanese government to expel him.
And how did he change then?
Well, it appears that while he was supporting various things at the time in the Sudan, and we had some suspicion that he was making contact at that time with the defeated Saddam Hussein regime in Iraq, he was involved in a lot of public works in the Sudan. There were funds and building projects that his family got involved in, that he was involved in, ports, airports, roads. And then the U.S. government put a lot of pressure on the Sudanese to expel him. And it was in that expulsion to Afghanistan that we also start to see more activity around the world.
More terrorist activity?
More terrorist activity. In other words, as I think Milt Bearden put it in the documentary, it was like the Germans sending Lenin to the Finland station, if you remember, in the First World War, as a way of destabilizing Russia. They forced Lenin out of exile in Switzerland, sent him back to Russia, and the result was, yes, it destabilized the Tsar, but it also created a huge revolution, which we now know was the Bolshevik Revolution. Once he's in Afghanistan, some people feel he was beyond our reach. And he was also convinced at that point that he was a pariah. There was no place he could go.
My guest is Lowell Bergman, the correspondent for the PBS Frontline documentary on Osama bin Laden. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Lowell Bergman, the correspondent for the PBS Frontline documentary on Osama bin Laden. Bin Laden has described the U.S. military presence in Saudi Arabia as an occupation of the land of the holy places. I mean, one of the reasons why he hates the United States is the United States' military connection with Saudi Arabia. Does his family still live and build in Saudi Arabia? Are they still prominent in Saudi Arabia?
Oh, they're very prominent there. They live around the world. There are many members of the family in the United States. They are major contributors to one of their alumni universities. They're alumni of Harvard. The family is very active. Apparently most of the family has had very little contact with them, if any contact. There are some stories that the older sons tried to make him whole once he was expelled from Saudi Arabia to get him some of the money. There's some skepticism about whether he really ever got the $300 million that was his share, but it's clearly he got some of it.
Was he on the outs with his family, or does his family still support him, and is he still
On a personal level, you mean?
Yeah, I'm wondering if they have tried to disavow his actions.
Oh, yeah, no, they formally have disavowed him and officially disavowed him. The problem is that they are also a traditional Islamic family, and there are some, you know, very strict, if you will, strictures about what their behavior should be towards a member of the family and be supportive of a member of family, whatever they do. And there's a conflict, I believe, in among some members of the family over that issue. But I don't think anyone in the U.S. government or anywhere would assume that they are doing anything to support him in his current activities. But also, as some people close to the family have indicated in conversation, you know, he has been made out to be, if you will, the evil mastermind, the penguin as in a Batman comic. A cartoon role, if you will, and on the street in many areas of the Muslim world, that makes him into a sort of hero to poor people who feel oppressed by their local government a local government that, let's say, is supported by the United States. He's been able to defy the superpower. And there are many who believe that has, if you will, is having a boomerang effect, when in reality, he can't be doing all of this by himself. And it's clear that certain veteran, if you will, underground organizations of Islamic fundamentalists, primarily out of Egypt, but also other countries, are really the foot soldiers and, if you will, the tactical commanders here.
The people that have been arrested so far, detained in the United States, are they basically foot soldiers, or do you think, where do you think they fit in the organization?
Well, I don't know a lot of detail about each one of them, and I would hesitate to speculate. I know that from the prior cases, it's clear that in the Nairobi bombing case, the defendants in those cases were basically low-level people. One of them, who was the American citizen, Wadi El-Haj, wasn't even in Nairobi, hadn't been there for, I think, 9 months or 10 months. And at best can be described as a logistical support person for the general organization. Clearly, no one there may be amongst the people who have been arrested so far, but clearly the people who died in the aircraft, the hijackers themselves, were expendable. And one of the mysteries here is how this was done and how it was organized and where is the infrastructure. In the wake of the Nairobi bombing and in the documentary, and I think on the website, we posted a document we obtained, which was a list of people who had not been arrested in Nairobi, a large, long list. And it included Egyptians and Palestinians and others who were described as being involved in the command and control part of the apparatus. So clearly, this is an organization that is self-perpetuating, that understands that it has to take casualties. In fact, its people are willing to be casualties, and has not really been seriously damaged, despite the fact that we spend $11 billion a year on counterterrorism operations.
You know, in trying to understand the mentality of people who can take planes of hostages and crash them into the World Trade Center and kill over 5,000 people, one can only think, well, they're insane, they're mad, they're evil personified, they're pathological. With the information you've been able to gather about Bin Laden, who, whether he's directly responsible for this or not, is certainly a key part of the network that is.
You know, he hasn't crashed into any buildings.
Right, yeah, good point. Is there any evidence that you have that you could say that he's mad, he's insane, he's pathological?
Well, it may be that he is mad and insane, and it's very possible, as many Muslims say, that this is, you know, completely contrary to their beliefs, committing suicide, doing anything. The same could be said of many people of, with a Christian or Jewish background. I mean, was Hitler mad and insane? Probably. The fact is people followed him. And the fact is he hit a certain chord with a certain group of people at a certain particular time in history. And what Bin Laden is feeding off of in many ways, and I don't think this is any secret to people who have been in the Muslim world, is a tremendous frustration on the street with the choices you have in life. And the result of that is people are prone to make choices like this. One of the people who escaped the Nairobi bombing, but whose computer files were seized actually 9 months before the bombing in Kenya in a counterterrorism operation, a man named Faroun Hazul, comes from the obscure Comoros Islands in the Indian Ocean off of East Africa. And as in the background that we did on him, he was a well-liked young man who did well in high school, but when he got to the point of graduating from high school, there was no future for him, no jobs, nothing he could do there. The former U.S. aid program, which would give people education grants, possibly even bring them to the U.S., had been terminated. Remember when we got rid of foreign aid?
Mm-hmm.
So the only thing open to him was a scholarship program into an Islamic fundamentalist university in Egypt. And that was the beginning of his trek to Afghanistan.
Well, you can't exactly call Bin Laden disenfranchised, though. Maybe a lot of his followers feel they have no choices and that they're poor, and maybe they feel the West is partially responsible for that. But Bin Laden, comes from a family that has a huge fortune. They're incredibly successful. He can't have any of those "I am disenfranchised" type complaints.
Look, Karl Marx wasn't born to poverty either, and neither was Engels. He was the son of a rich textile manufacturer in England.
Or Che Guevara.
Or Che Guevara, or Fidel Castro, or, you know, and you can go down the list. The ability to have, let's say, an intellectual or personal ability to synthesize things and bring them together and get people to identify with you, generally speaking, is a result not just of your personal experience in material terms, but also what your understanding is of events and how you can influence people. And clearly, despite the fact that he has the advantage of having a lot of money, he also had the advantage of being able to lead a large number of people who weren't as well educated as he is.
Because bin Laden has a lot of money, you might say, well, to get to him, follow the money, because there must be quite a money trail. What are some of the difficulties in following the money in this particular case?
Well, theoretically, we were supposed to be improving our intelligence ability in that area, although it's not clear what has happened. Apparently, there were some recommendations out of the Nairobi bombing that apparently haven't been put into effect yet with the Treasury Department. But it's extremely difficult because he would be operating in countries where there's bank secrecy, or a country like Dubai, which has a large number of what are called Islamic banks that don't operate the same way, with the same, let's say, disclosure that we would be used to. So it'd be very difficult to get a sense of how much money is involved. But again, and I do believe it's been reported that there have been some pretty successful disruptions of some of his accounts in what we'd call more legitimate institutions. But go back and look about what we know so far about this hijacking. Yes, there was some tens of thousands of dollars spent on flight schools, but it doesn't sound to me like this was a very, in the U.S., in a state-sponsored sense, high-budget operation. They were flying around. They got airplane tickets. I would bet when we get down to it, all of these people had jobs and were working, you know, blending into the community, but also supporting themselves.
Lowell Bergman is the correspondent for the PBS Frontline documentary on Osama bin Laden. Our conversation was recorded earlier today. We'll hear more of it in the second half of the show. The Frontline website has a lot of information about bin Laden. You can access it through the website pbs.org. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, promoting excellence in journalism worldwide and investing in the vitality of 26 U.S. communities. From the National Endowment for the Arts, and from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more on Osama bin Laden with PBS Frontline correspondent Lowell Bergman. We look at the relationship between bin Laden, the Taliban, and Pakistan with Thomas Goodyear, an expert on Afghanistan. And Rabbi Burton Vizotsky reflects on the Jewish High Holy Days, which begin tonight. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Lowell Bergman, the correspondent for the PBS Frontline documentary about Osama bin Laden, the prime suspect in last week's attacks. Bergman is currently working on an updated version of the documentary, which is scheduled for broadcast October 4th. I know that you'd have no reason to know this, but based on what you do know from the research that you've done on bin Laden, do you think that the network has kind of exhausted itself temporarily by putting together the actions of last week, or do you think that that could just be a first step with another terrorist action soon to follow?
I think one of the unusual things here is that we don't know, apparently. And I think that's one of the questions that I would hope gets raised in the near future about what it is we do know and why it is we don't know certain things. A former senior official of the FBI said to me the other day that if President Bush goes in to see the head of the CIA and says, "Where is bin Laden?" and he's told that he doesn't know, some people probably should resign. This is a very unusual. This is probably the biggest intelligence failure in the history of the United States, with the exception maybe of Pearl Harbor. And if you remember, in Pearl Harbor, the field commanders at the time resigned.
You have gone through, I imagine, every public statement that bin Laden has made. Are there any that particularly ring in your ears right now?
The most interesting thing about what he has had to say in the past is that it's consistent and unwavering, and he's saying that, you know, "I applaud what was done. I think it was a great idea, but I wasn't involved directly." Now, remember the blind sheikh, Sheikh Omar Rahman, who was has been put away in the United States in jail for allegedly being involved in attempting a bombing conspiracy on pretty thin undercover evidence, was perceived much the same way as a spiritual guidance leader, possibly financier of actions that he wouldn't necessarily know about. And this pattern is similar in, let's say, the Hezbollah. The Sheikh Fadlallah, who's the spiritual leader there as well, he may have blessed a suicide bomber, as alleged by the U.S. State Department in Beirut, who was heading to the U.S. Embassy. But it isn't clear that he is directing activities. I think that's the thing to keep in mind here. You may think you're taking the head off, but it may not be the head.
What would it be?
Clearly, there are lots of other people who are involved. We're talking about 20, 30, 40, 50 or more people involved in the infrastructure beyond the people who did the hijackings themselves. And that means that there are people who have been coordinating things and are still out there. And I think that we'll find, as I think we are finding, that they are of different nationalities in different places, both in the United States and other countries.
What have been some of the difficulties on reporting on bin Laden when he is so well hidden?
Well, in a sense, when you get involved in this, you're not reporting so much on him, but on the phenomenon. In other words, look at it this way. And in the documentary, we interview somebody who was a personal assistant to the blind sheikh. He describes how he got to the point of being a supporter in principle of what happened at the World Trade Center, or let's say what happened the other day. And I think the most important thing for us to start understanding is that these are human beings. However wrong they may be about the conclusions and the actions that they take, we better understand what the motivation is here and why we get identified. And the answer that keeps popping up is it isn't just our backing of Israel. It's our support for regimes that we ourselves as Americans would find distasteful, regimes that don't provide an outlet for their own people, and regimes in many cases, as in the Egyptian case, that don't allow people to have any dissent or even to develop their own ability to have a better life. And that's an underlying factor here in these various fratricidal wars that are going on in different countries that and also regimes that produce, if you will, the cannon fodder who are behind the controls in those airplanes.
Now, I feel like I can comprehend that. But at the same time, the Taliban regime in Afghanistan, which is a regime that has been harboring bin Laden, I mean, this is a regime that stands against all kinds of freedoms. Women can barely go out of the house. They haven't been allowed to work or go to school during much of the Taliban regime. Nobody has any freedom. These guys are even, like, smashing ancient art objects.
Right. The Buddhists are not happy with them.
Yeah, so it's hard to really comprehend the argument that, well, it's because...
Well, but let's look at it again.
Yeah.
Very few Afghanis are involved in any of these acts overseas.
Mm-hmm.
You're not finding Taliban, if you will, members or devotees in these international operations. Most of the Afghanis, in fact, who are overseas are refugees who hate the Taliban. Look at the people who are actually carrying out the acts. Where do they come from? And
where is that? Where do they come from?
They're Saudis, they're Egyptians, they're Palestinians, they're in some rare cases, but maybe a Somali here and there. The people that we know of are from those countries, and in one case, an American citizen, apparently. So it's not what the Afghan situation is with the Taliban is that they are harboring him, they are allowing him to live there, to have his entourage, and according to reports, he's also been pouring some money into the country because they don't have any money. And also look at who the Taliban's allies have been and help them. They were allied strongly to the Pakistani government, to an element of their secret police and army. There is a whole other area that hasn't been gotten into yet, which has to do with the drug traffic out of Afghanistan through Pakistan. So the Taliban themselves, while they ideologically or from a religious point of view are very sympathetic or on the same wavelength in many ways as bin Laden, have not been active internationally, and nor do we see many of those people operating against us directly, although we're about to probably do something to them.
Well, Lowell Bergman, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Lowell Bergman is the correspondent for the PBS Frontline documentary on Osama bin Laden. He's now working on an updated version, which is scheduled for broadcast October 4th. The Frontline website has a lot of background on bin Laden. You can access it through the website pbs.org. Coming up, the relationship between bin Laden, the Taliban, and Pakistan. This is Fresh Air. The Taliban, the extremist fundamentalist rulers of Afghanistan, are facing an ultimatum: turn over Osama bin Laden or face military strikes. Earlier today, a Pakistani delegation, under pressure from the United States, asked the Taliban to comply with the ultimatum. The Taliban leader said he will allow a council of Islamic clerics to decide how to respond. In the meantime, Pakistan and Afghanistan say they are building up troops on their common border. To understand the complicated relationships between the U.S., Pakistan, and Afghanistan, it's helpful to go back to the 1980s, when the Afghanistan resistance, known as the Mujahideen, drove out the Soviets, which had invaded their country. The U.S. and Pakistan backed the Afghan resistance. My guest, Thomas Gutierrez, is the director of the Center for Afghanistan Studies at the University of Nebraska. We spoke earlier today. In the 80s, during the war between Afghanistan and the Soviet Union, Pakistan was kind of on the same side that we were.
Oh, yes.
Right. And Pakistan was the depot for the arms that the United States and other countries were getting to the resistance fighters in Afghanistan, the Mujahideen. So talk a little bit about how the relationship with Pakistan and the Taliban developed after the war in Afghanistan was over, when the Taliban came to power. Did Pakistan help the Taliban come to power?
Well, the Taliban were comprised originally of a group of some small numbers of former commanders who had been fighting in the war against the Soviet Union, who themselves were, you know, were part of the Mujahideen elements. And they were distressed at the inability of the Mujahideen parties to put together a coherent, stable government in Kabul. Eventually, the Taliban and people around Kandahar were wanting to revolt against the or demonstrate against the ineffectiveness of this situation with the Mujahideen government. And they captured a couple of spots and fought against a couple of these. And the Pakistanis, I think, were amazed with the alacrity which, with the Afghans in the area, came over to them, because they really weren't on anybody's radar screen until then. And so, recognizing that what was going on in Kabul wasn't going to work for them, they quickly switched their connections to the Taliban. And they had a kind of charismatic appeal to Afghans, because their name means essentially students. And all of a sudden, their ranks started to swell dramatically. The ranks were swelling not from people who had been formerly in the Mujahideen ranks so much, but by Afghans who were in the refugee camps and religious schools in Pakistan during the war with the Soviet Union, now who were maturing enough to be old enough in their late teens to fight on behalf of the Taliban. And so with this kind of connection between the Pakistani military intelligence, the Pakistani military, and the Taliban themselves, the Taliban started to move with Pakistani tactical support and advisors against the rest of Afghanistan. And this was all strengthened eventually in the late spring, early summer of 1996, when the Pakistanis brokered the return of Osama bin Laden to Afghanistan.
So what is the connection between the Pakistani government and bin Laden?
Well, as we know, bin Laden was, as we've discussed already, was fighting on behalf of the Afghans against the Soviets. Essentially, around the time that the Soviets pulled out their troops, Osama bin Laden went back to Saudi Arabia. And there he became embroiled in protests and demonstrations against the American Western United Nations presence in the Persian Gulf. He felt it was a desecration of holy Arabian soil to have the house of Mecca and Medina, to have these foreigners there propping up a monarchy and government which he believed was not sufficiently, Islamic enough. And with that, he was thrown out of Saudi Arabia and had his passport taken away. He went to Sudan, where he began developing training camps for terrorism against Saudi Arabia and the West to remove the West initially just from the Persian Gulf, and then that, of course, is, as we know now, is extended beyond that objective. And the Saudis and the U.S. pressured the Sudan to kick him out. And when that happened, the Pakistani military intelligence and the Pakistani military brokered a return for him to Afghanistan. And, during the time that Gulbuddin Hikmetyar was the prime minister in the Rabbani government, which never was a marriage of anything more than convenience, they never were in the same almost city at the same time. But so he came in at that time and introduced by the Pakistanis, and he went to eastern Afghanistan. At this time, I was with the United Nations Special Mission to Afghanistan, and I was asked to try and learn, what was the objective of Osama bin Laden, and was he really back in Afghanistan? And indeed learned that he was, and that he was there to support, initially he came in to support maybe the more extreme elements, Gulbuddin Hikmetyar, in the fight amongst the Mujahideen. Now, by the time I got there, he was already working with the Taliban, having been, introduced to them by the Pakistani military intelligence.
So the government of Pakistan helped get bin Laden into Afghanistan, which he has made his home base.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're asking the government of Pakistan to get bin Laden out. What does the government in Pakistan stand for now, and how close of a tie do they still have with the Taliban and with bin Laden?
Well, I think that the current government in Pakistan, led by General Musharraf, who is now the president of this military government, is beginning to understand that the relationship that it put together between Pakistan, in other words, in a previous iteration of the government, between the Taliban, the Pakistanis, and Osama bin Laden is in some ways coming home to roost in its own territory. The training camps in Pakistan that were training people for Kashmir and Afghanistan sent people out to those places. They've come back, and they themselves are not very pleased about the political makeup of their own country. So they are kind of a disaffected group of people who are, readily available to march to the streets. And there are also numbers of these same people who have gone into the military and now are part of the military ranks. This means that military is not as secular as it was in its past. So this is a situation where the Pakistanis themselves have a very difficult situation, trying to undo, in some ways, a situation in which they have been the major, masterminds, and now they're understanding that perhaps this is going to be too problematic for their own interest in future, and are using this opportunity perhaps to extricate themselves from this entangled, unholy alliance between Pakistan's military intelligence, Osama bin Laden, and the Taliban.
The Taliban have vowed to retaliate against any country that sides with the United States. What kind of military power do they have to retaliate? Is there retaliation? Can they retaliate only in terms of terrorism, or do they actually have a military?
Well, they have what we would recognize as a loosely collected military, enough people to be significant, but not the kind that could march across the border and deal in what we would call standard warfare. It's a hodgepodge, a creation of various groups from various parts around the country that are largely they're disciplined in their religion, but not so highly disciplined in their military, processes. What they have, and when they make these threats, are the same type. They have the connections with Osama bin Laden, perhaps, or they have the connections with the extremist religious parties in Pakistan who support them and Osama bin Laden. And so they're able to use that as a threat. And I think that's a threat which concerns the current Pakistani military government led by General Musharraf. So they are capable of raising threats, yes, but I don't think that we need to expect that they're going to in any time seek to invade Pakistan in retribution. That's not just a possibility.
There's some concern that if Pakistan sides with the United States, that there will be an insurrection within Pakistan and that fundamentalists siding with the Taliban will overthrow the current government, and that alliances will really shift after that. How concerned are you about that?
I think that's a very real possibility, that there at least would be mass demonstrations and the possibility of also bringing, the commerce of the country to a halt. But I think that the Pakistani military at this stage is probably understanding that, if not now, this whole situation is likely to occur sometime in the not too distant future, and maybe this particular juncture gives them a chance to reassert a secularist hold over Pakistan. I think that we should, depending on the degree to which Pakistan really does go along with the United States and NATO on this, we should not be surprised if there are these continuing demonstrations, and even perhaps inside Pakistan, the need for some martial law and military clampdown on political parties that are the allies of Osama bin Laden and the Taliban.
You're saying you don't take what the Pakistan government says at face value?
Well, right now we have to take it at face value. But at the same time, I think we need to be insistent upon, they're upholding what they say they are going to do. Close the borders, break off with the Taliban, don't support them anymore. Those are things that in the past they were unwilling to do. And they say now they are willing to do that. We need to monitor that indeed they're being truthful at this time in doing so.
Just one last question. How long can the Taliban go on without the support of Pakistan?
Without the support of Pakistan and Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden's movement, the Taliban probably cannot go on very long at all. I think at this stage, the Taliban are very dependent upon the fighting forces that come to them through the extremist religious schools in Pakistan and the Arabs and Central Asians that Osama bin Laden recruits for his Al-Qaeda movement, which are forming a lot of the frontline brigades in the struggle against the northern opposition and other pockets of resistance in Afghanistan. I think if these two resources are removed from the Taliban resource base, that the other Afghans throughout the country will see that, you know, the tide is turning, and it will weaken the Taliban very, very severely.
Thomas Gutierrez, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Nice to be with you, Terry.
Thomas Gutierrez is the director of the Center for Afghanistan Studies at the University of Nebraska in Omaha. Coming up, Rabbi Burton Vizotsky on observing the Jewish High Holy Days in the wake of last week's attacks. This is Fresh Air. This evening is the start of the Jewish High Holy Days, which begin with the Jewish New Year and conclude next week with Yom Kippur, a day of fasting and atonement. Earlier today, I called Rabbi Burton Vizotsky, a professor at the Jewish Theological Seminary, which is based in Manhattan. He will deliver a sermon tomorrow at a congregation in suburban Washington, D.C. People will be looking to you in the congregation to help find some meaning or make some sense or at least just go on with their lives in the wake of last week's catastrophe. Where have you been looking?
Well, the truth is, you know, like all rabbis, we are looked to for advice, and we are mere humans who maybe don't experience life any better than anyone else, but we have the advantage of thousands of years of tradition. I personally have taken a great deal of comfort from a psalm that we do say at this season for the last month and through the next couple of weeks. We say the 27th psalm, which ends with the words, have hope and courage and seek God. And I think that for me, that psalm kind of speaks well. It talks about when your enemies rise against you, if your mother and father have left you, God will gather you in, God will be your protector. And I think at a time like this when we all felt so helpless, so impotent, that we have to recognize that as humans we are impotent sometimes, and that the only succor we have, the only hope we can have, is to look to something higher. So almost all of us, no matter what our religion, I think, find ourselves looking to God now.
I know that a lot of people are turning to God now. Among the people turning to God, though, are the people who bombed the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. They consider themselves very holy, very pious. I think we'd all agree that they have terribly and tragically misinterpreted the Quran, but still in their minds, they're being pious and holy. And I wonder, what effect that has on you as a religious man?
It makes me very angry. This is not the first time. In fact, for thousands of years, maniacs and megalomaniacs have hidden behind the shield of piety or pretense that religion somehow permits them to commit atrocities. And this is true in all the great religions, unfortunately. As early as the Hebrew Bible, the New Testament, the Quran, you find that struggle with the kind of strains of militantism as opposed to the consistent message that you find overwhelmingly in the New Testament and in the Hebrew Bible and in the Quran, which is God's love and peace. So we recognize that in every community there will be crazies and that they will raise up the shield of their religion as an excuse to go out and commit atrocity. That does not make them true representatives of the religion. And I think that on the whole, Islam has been a great religion of peace and a great force in the world. So to say that these guys are true Muslims, I think, is to miss the point, and for them to tragically miss the point. They're just abusing Islam.
Have you been having a lot of people come up to you and say, Rabbi, how can this kind of catastrophe happen? How can God let this happen?
Yes, I have. That people always search for answers. People are groping. I mean, the trauma is so immense that I think everyone wants a simple answer. And the truth is, God doesn't intervene in the world. God has given us free will, which means that horrible tragedies can happen. And maybe sometimes we can rail against God and wish it were otherwise. And perhaps that's a psychological help, that we have some place to turn our dismay and anger. And after we unload all of that dismay and anger, maybe God is still there listening so that we can find some way to find some support from God. This Sunday, I had the good fortune to have a family wedding that went on. And I must say that in a week of horror, it was nice to have a little joy. In a week of despair, it was good to have a little hope. And in a week that we saw ungodly hate, it was great to celebrate love.
Rabbi Vysotsky, thank you very much, and I wish you a good new year.
Thank you, Terry, and you too.
Rabbi Burton Vysotsky is a professor at the Jewish Theological Seminary in Manhattan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Monique Nazareth, and Naomi Person, with Megan Howell, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Officer of the Court, a suspense novel of World War II by Bill Macy Jr., author of The Advocate. From Saab, maker of the 9.5 sedan and the 9.5 wagon. Independent quality and safety evaluations of Saab 9.5's performance available at saabusa.com. And from Random House Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publishers of Paris to the Moon by Adam Gopnik, available wherever books are sold. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our coverage of the war and the recent history behind it. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.